since he'd been raised in the nearest breeding ground and moved to the plant when he was of age. By the time they stopped, Alec was drenched with sweat, and he was grateful for the short hair as Monet led him to a country house.
"Whose house is this?" he asked.
"It's ours," she said.
"Ours?" he asked.
"Tom really didn't tell you anything, did he?"
Alec was hurt. There was so much he didn't know about the man. He glanced at the bracelet clamped around his wrist, blocking his ID tracker, and was grateful he'd at least left Alec one thing of value.
"Don't take it too hard. We have a rule. We don't tell anyone what's inside the factories. It's too dangerous." "He shouldn't have given you that either. Think of it as a sign he was looking out for you," she said as they stopped on the old farmhouse's front porch.
Monet scanned the sky for signs of seekers, and Alec peered around the fields for trackers. When they were satisfied they hadn't been followed, Monet led him inside. The place was a mess. A skeleton sat in a chair in a room filled with stacks of boxes and an old television.
"This is your house?"
he asked again. She laughed, and the sound was alien to his ears. He felt like joining her, but didn't know where to begin.
"No, this is."
She opened a door with a numbered padlock on it, and Alec saw steps leading to a dark basement. What had he gotten himself into? Still, this was better than biding his time, waiting to die at the factory. His heart raced as he followed the formidable woman into the recesses of the home. The basement had a stale scent to it that made it hard to breathe. They stepped over a damp carpet and stopped at a wood-paneled wall. She felt along its edges before pushing on the wood. It clicked and swung open.
"Welcome to the Reclaimers, Alec."
She said the words without a hint of malice, and he scanned the room. Light snuck in through white curtains over a tiny barred window, and Monet flipped a switch on. Alec didn't even ask how they had a power source out there in the middle of nowhere. The inside of this secret room was nothing like the rest of the house. It was clean, sealed off from the rot of the world. The wooden floor had a light layer of dust on it, and he could see old footprints across the powder. Black crates lined the far wall, and a table with two chairs sat along the other wall. There were also two cots on the ground, with pillows and blankets.
"I know. Quite the luxury after what you've been living in. There's food under the table. Help yourself."
Monet crossed the room and opened a tall cabinet after punching in a series of numbers onto a keypad. The door swung wide to reveal at least 10 guns of varying sizes standing side by side. Alec's stomach growled at the idea of food, but he walked over to Monet's side to stare at the weapons.
"What are the Reclaimers?" he asked.
She took a handheld gun, clicked something into it, and motioned for Alec to sit at the table.
"I think we'd better have that talk now."
Alec's head was spinning as they opened a box under the table to find real food, canned goods that weren't 23 years past their expiration dates.
"We still manufacture food. The overseers kept plants open around the world for this purpose. They need to feed the bastards that choose to work with them. The supervisors, the guards, the hunters."
She said the last one with hatred, and Alec decided not to ask what a hunter was quite yet. There was so much he didn't know.
"What else is there?" "Pretty much the gruel they feed the workers and breeders. It's full of most nutrients you need to survive. Other than that, it's canned goods, pre-mixed food. There are thousands of farms being worked, mostly by human slaves, but there are worse places to be than outside tilling the crops."
Monet said it like she had experience in the fields.
"Alec, humanity was almost wiped out. How old are you? Were you born before or after?"
"Before. But barely, at least that's what Tom told me."
She glanced at him, staring for a second before nodding.
"We estimate there are only 10 million people alive in the United States, about 200 million in the world. Of course, there's no way to know for sure, especially with the number of freeborns we see popping up all over the place.
Freeborns? Alec asked, the word tasting funny on his tongue.
Those born outside the occupation. There are thousands of small groups hidden around the country living on the other side of the Overseer's radars,
Monet said. Alec took a bite of the food from the can before him and nearly fell over at the flavor.
You're supposed to heat it up first, Monet said with a laugh. I'll show you.
She grabbed two bowls from under the table and stuck the food inside a silver box. The lights dimmed as it activated. Alec watched through the glass casing as the bowls of food turned slowly as the machine operated.
There are people out there born without ID tags?
Alec finally clued in to what she'd been saying.
That's right, lots of them.
Are they rising up against the Overseers?
He asked, his pulse picking up speed again as he waited for her answer.
Unfortunately, no. Most of them are too scared to go outside, let alone join the Reclaimers. Believe me, we've traveled far and wide attempting to recruit. We can do a lot with weapons and technology, but we still need people to operate them.
Are you saying those Reclaimers have more guns than that?
He pointed to the cabinet full of weaponry. She laughed again, a thick, throaty sound. Her eyes danced as she glared back at him. Seeing her like that made him miss his sulky friend Beth even more.
You have no idea. And now that we have the asset from Detroit, we're finally on to something.
She patted her pocket where she'd placed the device Alec had smuggled out of the factory.
Jackfish. Jackfish knew what he was offering us. I'm sorry about your friend. That wasn't supposed to happen. The guards rarely shoot bystanders by accident,
she said, pulling the bowls from the whirring box. The bowl steamed, and the smell of thick red food almost made his eyes water in joy.
He knew he was going to die?
She nodded, passing him a spoon.
That's what Reclaimers are prepared to do.
Die?
Sacrifice for our greater good.
That made sense, but Alec still didn't feel like he had a grasp of what he was getting involved with.
What's on the device? What do you think you were building in there?
She asked, turning his question around on him.
I have no idea. They don't tell us anything.
The supervisor has blueprints, and we follow orders, Alec said before taking a bite.
It was hot, but the flavors exploded in his mouth. It was the best thing he'd ever eaten. It was the only thing other than his daily allowance of slop he'd tasted.
We'd think it's a gate,
Monet started to eat.
A gate? What does that mean?
He asked, his curiosity more than piqued.
If our intel is accurate, they're trying to build a gateway so their kind can walk between our world and theirs. No more interstellar travel in those ships of theirs. It took them generations to arrive, and now they want to build a bridge to allow the rest of their kind access to Earth,
Monet said between bites. Most of this was beyond Alec's understanding, and he felt stupid for not following.
The Overseers came from another world, taking a long time. Now we're building a device that they can walk through to get to Earth? Does that mean they have a gate on their planet? Tom said you were bright,
she said with a smile.
If this is what we think it is, then yes, they have the other side waiting to be activated on their homeworld.
Monet finished her food off and Alec glanced at the last few bites in his bowl. This was all too much to handle. His life had been flipped upside down. He'd never considered where they were from for more than a fleeting moment years ago, and now he was learning this wasn't even as bad as it was going to get.
They're just using us, he said.
She nodded.
Do you think they'll keep us around after the others arrive? I believe they're growing used to us being there. Why dispose of an animal that does your chores for you?
She asked, giving Alec a lot to think about.
Where's Tom?
Is he alive?
Alec said. She smiled again.
Very much so. He's at our base. We had him sent to Detroit years ago on an intel mission. When he got all he could, he was pulled out. He felt so terrible about not being able to bring you with him.
Relief flooded Alec.
You have no idea how happy I am to hear that, he said.
The food, the news of his friend being alive, wasn't enough to counter the despair he'd felt from Beth's death. But he had a focus now.
I want to join the Reclaimers. Alec let his spoon fall to clang inside the bowl.
She took the gun from her pocket, set it on the table, and slid it toward him.
I think you already have.
15. Lena. It took Lena all of that afternoon to start talking to herself. The cumulative effects of the stress, the loss and fear, the dehydration and hunger had left their mark, but in the end, it was the utterly overwhelming sensation of pure isolation that stopped her. She sat hard against a rock at the river she followed as it wound its way north, leaning her head back to drink the clear water from the bottle she'd been using, and couldn't hold it together long enough to get the water to her lips. She broke, her mouth issuing a sob sounding so unlike her that she thought, for a fleeting second, that someone else was there. She collapsed onto the dirt beside the river, tucking her knees up to her chest like a child, and crying so hard that she lost all track of time. When the tears subsided, when the effort of her breakdown had forced her into a short and uncomfortable period of unconsciousness so far removed from being asleep that she actually woke more exhausted than when she started, she seemed better. The upset was gone. The fear was still there, but it was no longer the fear of being alone. Instead, it was the genuine and very real fear of being caught. Whatever part of her needed other people, reassurance, and companionship, that part seemed to have been driven away by her tears, frightened off with no real way of knowing if it would ever return. Standing up and brushing off the dirt and leaves from her clothes, Lena drank her fill from the river and topped off both the bottle she carried and the cooking pot she had adopted as one of her most prized possessions. As the sun began to rise, she ate her fill, dreading the consequences of yet another belly full of fresh fruit. Movement out of the corner of her eye made her spin towards the water, fearful at first, but relaxing when she realized what it had been. When it dawned on her fully that she was looking at a fish that was more than sufficient enough to sustain her, she tried to rack her brain for a way to get the fat fish out of the cool water and onto dry land where she could eat it. Cutting away at the younger trees, she fashioned herself a mostly straight pole and used her knife to sharpen the end into a point and a rock to hit the top of the blade and cut that point into four and wedge a small rock into the end to splay out the four sharp points. She'd seen the people who fished their huge lake back home do this, standing like a statue in the shallows for hours to spear the precious protein. Lena hadn't done it herself, not even as a child when they were taught to do bits of everything, but she didn't think to admit to herself that she couldn't do something. She knew the theory, part of it at least, and the rest she would figure out. An hour she spent there, missing with her first three attempts when the fish swam close enough for her to strike. In the end, she was forced to remove her new pants and stand in the water, which came to just above her knees, and wade carefully upstream over the smooth, slick rocks beneath her bare feet. Her first attempt, while in her prey's natural environment, was a failure, as she realized too late that the fish wasn't where she thought it would be because of the way the water bent the light. When she had figured out that important fact, her next strike speared the fish with two of the sharp points for it to thrash against her makeshift tool with more power than she thought possible. Then the thrashing stopped, and when the silt and mud stirred up from the disturbed stream bed cleared, she found a small chunk of flesh stuck between the spikes, but no fish. Exasperated, she threw the spear into the water, losing the vital mouthful of food she needed, and climbed out to pace up and down on the bank as she muttered angrily to herself. No sign of any of the other fish could be seen, so she put her pants and boots on and stomped on throughout the gathering heat of the morning until she had drunk all of her water. She knelt to the river, swollen now with bubbling froth, lingering where the watercourse ran across larger boulders, and filled her bottle to take another drink. It tasted wrong, somehow. She couldn't say why or how, but the tepid water she had finished tasted better than the fresher, cooler liquid she had taken. She decided that after wasting an hour and all of the energy expended on the fish who easily avoided her, she wasn't going to waste any more time trying to figure this out, and drank it before walking onwards. A whining, buzzing noise sounded from up ahead of her, where a tree had fallen in the water, and she couldn't help but lean over to look. She wished she hadn't. The buzzing noise was caused by the flies. They teemed above the thing caught against the trapped tree trunk, and in response to her presence, a huge swathe of the parasites flew away to expose a mess of rotting meat and bone under a sagging, soaked hide. Maggots and a thin stream of dark gore flowed out of the dead animal, no longer recognizable as belonging to any specific species. And as her eyes followed the gore downstream, they rested on the water bottle in her hand. With feverish hands, she unscrewed the cap of the bottle and poured and shook it until every drop of the contaminated liquid was gone. She staggered to her feet and ran away from the rotting carcass, hoping to leave behind the knowledge of what she had ingested. Unless something major had changed in the world, the sun still rose in the east. As she was heading north and the sun had not long risen, it should be on her right side. But it was behind her, which, even to Lena in the state she was in, meant that she was heading west.
"They said we have to go north,"
she told herself, muttering as though she argued with someone in public and didn't want the world to hear their problems.
"It was the last thing they said before—"
She paced and banged the heels of both hands into her temples.
"We have to go north!"
Logically, after she had calmed a little more, she knew that leaving the river was a survival choice, as it meant leaving a guaranteed source of fresh water, despite the recent events she tried not to think of, and also food if she could master fishing and live off the foraged berries. Without a map, without a guide, she had no way of knowing if that river swung back to the north after a long sweeping bend west, or if it carried on out that way to another mountain range that wasn't the one she needed to find. Forcing herself to wash out and refill her two bottles, she turned her back to the river and, feeling the overwhelming urge to find somewhere to sleep, Lena tightened the straps of her pack and picked up the heavy shotgun as she set off into the sunlight to find a safe place to rest. Cole spent a whole afternoon chopping up dried wood, which he guessed had been part of some old fence, using it to keep the small fire going, to dry the strips of meat from the second turkey he'd caught. His trap hadn't sprung, which he thought was strange, but the big birds obviously weren't the smartest of things, or had missed what he had done to their buddy the day before because another one wandered foolishly close enough for him to grab. He carried it up the hill to his little slice of home, not that home was something he had ever really known, and had almost discarded the head until he remembered his tenant. Cole tossed the coyote the turkey head and kept moving, the sound of crunching bones following after him. As he wasn't in need of a meal, and because he knew how quickly meat went bad in the dry heat, he used his knife to open up the skin of the bird and slice away long strips of meat from the breasts, which he laid across his metal mesh tray to dry them out over the fire he revived. Leaving a lot of meat on the carcass, which possessed all of its guts, he carried it carefully outside and decided to leave it in the open doorway to test the injured animal. If it couldn't walk the short distance to fetch the food, then he knew what would have to be done to it. But as he wasn't a healer, and the thing was likely to try and rip his throat out if he tried to help, he didn't think there was much more he could do for it but put it out of its misery quickly.
"Tomorrow," he told himself. "We'll see how you are tomorrow."
Glancing up at the skies, he saw a large patch of gray heading his way from the south and knew he would either get wet or be forced undercover. A snarl from the doorway reminded him that he was being watched.
"Rain coming," he told the animal, "which is good because any tracker on my scent would probably lose it after good rain. Lucky for once, huh?"
As though to underline the coyote's point, thunder began to roll through the distant landscape. SW-18 stopped and turned its head up to the skies. The head, or at least the articulating part of the chassis that mimicked a head, bobbed to collect the scent from the air and assess it. Any person watching it would say it was sniffing, that it was smelling the air, but it wasn't. It was drawing in samples of the local atmosphere and assessing it through an olfactory sensor array. It was following a program, not an instinct. The assessment told SW-18 that rain was imminent, given that an 86.97% chance of precipitation was interpreted as imminent. That changed the search parameters greatly, as it had followed a circuitous track in and out of a meandering water course for 2 days and nights, stopping only to power down to recharge for the minimum time calculated through the fold-out solar panel array built into the upper back of the chassis. The power banks, which made up the majority of the weight it locomoted, was essentially a multi-cell battery core that diminished in small sections, which were then sealed off until the recharging cycle reactivated them. SW-18 only recharged for as long as it had to, in order to not lose the long lead its quarry had stretched out ahead of its pursuit. Maintaining an operating power supply of around 30% meant that an extended period working through the rain would mean an enforced shutdown ahead of the preferred time period. If SW-18 could talk, it would have sighed and mumbled something like, "So be it," to itself before trudging onwards until it could go no further. Splashing in and out of the river to cast for the traces of scent on either bank made the progress in distance very slow, but each time it found the scent by doing what the programming titled as casting, whereby it went upriver away and scanned for the scent on both sides of the bank, it had learned enough about its prey to come close to appreciating a challenge. Conscious of the impending downpour as thunder pealed in the distance to serve as a reminder, SW-18 took a calculated gamble and stretched far ahead in a straight line at a running speed not optimal to maintaining battery life. It was, not that SW-18 would call it this, a gamble. But it was a wager that paid off because 3 miles further ahead, the fresher scent of vermin lit up SW-18's sensor array like an explosion. Only it was different. Instead of the wet smell of the young male, it detected the trail of a female instead. SW-18 turned in the direction that the new track faced and ran some quick calculations. Probability of locating original track and hunting down the first vermin, factoring in the imminent rainfall, was a little over 17%. Probability of tracking the fresher scent, even factoring in the rain, 66.4%. Unable to ignore the math, SW-18 set off at a more sedate pace in an attempt to make ground with optimum efficiency. But the storm clouds caught up with it, and the power reserves finally ran into the red and slowed the legs of the chassis until SW-18 was forced to contract in on itself and wait for sunlight. 16. Dex.
A knock at his door woke him, and he glanced at the window where the shades were pulled low. Judging by the light creeping inside the room, it was well into the afternoon.
"Who is it?"
he asked, crossing the area to pick up his Glock. He wasn't wearing a shirt, but his jeans were still on as well as his boots. He never knew when he'd need a quick escape.
"Kate, come on, let me in,"
she said. He unlatched the sliding chain and tugged the door open. The red-headed firecracker of a hunter stood there grinning at him like a cat about to pounce on a canary. Her eyes looked him up and down, stopping briefly at his torso. Deep white scars ran lengthwise over his chest, and he turned, grabbing a white t-shirt.
"Hello, Kate. What's the word?"
he asked, trying to keep it casual. Kate and he had a history, and he wasn't sure which woman was showing up at his door today.
"That's all you have for me?"
she asked, her voice holding a hint of a purr to it.
"What more do you want?"
She walked in, pressing her hand on his stomach.
"I can think of a few things,"
she said softly. Dex wasn't in the mood for Kate today. The business with the trackers, then the overseer's vessel, had set his nerves on edge.
"Stop, not today," he said more forcefully than he'd intended.
She took the hint and walked to the windows, opening the blinds.
"I heard about your job. What the hell happened?"
Dex grabbed a bottle of whiskey and her eyes widened at the sight.
"Now that's a sight for sore eyes," she said, sitting down at the tiny round table.
He didn't bother with glasses. He just twisted the top off and passed the bottle to her. He hadn't had so much as a sip of the case from Creston yet. She took a swig and water welled inside her clear eyes.
"Haven't had the good stuff in a long time. Where'd you find it?"
He told her about his trip to Creston and chasing down the accountant. She grimaced as he painted the picture of James's hand lying beside the skate sharpener. When he got to the part with the trackers, she tensed, taking another pull from the whiskey bottle.
"You have to be shitting me,"
she said. If there was one thing he could expect from Kate, she spoke her mind.
"Not at all. Killed him outright," Dex said.
"What kind of stuff was he into? Was he one of the terrorists?"
Kate almost spat as she said the word. Dex shook his head.
"Don't think so."
There was no way he was telling another soul about his conversation with Trent James, especially not a hunter, and doubly so Kate. She was a fanatic. She loved being a hunter. Dex knew she relished the fact that the overseers had come. He hadn't pieced much of her past out of her, but she was at least a couple years his junior. How she became so jaded at such a young age before the incursion was beyond him.
"Dex,"
she placed her hand on his, and he felt the roughness to them as she rubbed the back of his hand.
"Promise me something."
"What?"
Dex asked, taking a shot from the bottle. It burned a little going down. He put the whiskey on the table, finding he didn't have the stomach or head for it anymore. He thought about tossing the case away along with the old cigarettes, but he knew he wouldn't.
"We have to stick together. If something is coming down the pipeline that's going to mess with the hunters, we have to work as a team. You, me."
"The others?"
he asked, implying the other hunters. She didn't answer, and he knew what she was suggesting. It wasn't the first time she had brought up the idea of the two of them hunting as a team. It was done by a few couples out there, but even though he'd given in to her blatant advances on a few occasions, for him, it was nothing more than blowing off steam. He decided not to rock the boat.
"Of course, I promise," he lied.
This seemed to calm her, and they stayed there talking about her latest hunt, which it turned out was for a teenage girl escaping one of the facilities. Dex cringed and didn't ask if she went back alive or dead. He didn't want to know.
"Did you hear something?"
Kate asked, her gaze flicking to the door.
"Dex! Kate!"
Cleveland's voice boomed from outside the door before he banged on it. Dex hopped up and opened it.
"Big job came in. They want everyone in the quadrant anyway,"
Cleveland said. This surprised Dex. He'd heard of some larger hunts, but everyone sitting idle would be at least 8 hunters.
What the hell has him so riled up? Dex asked.
Not sure,
the boss said, and Dex looked over the big man's shoulders to see Clark, another hunter, jump into his Hummer, spin gravel toward the motel, and take off to the west.
Who's the target?
Kate asked.
2 of them.
Cleveland pulled out 2 files and handed them each one.
I've sent the details to your tablets, too. There's a prize in this for the winner. Whoever nabs 1 gets a month off. Nab them both and you get 3.
3 months off. Dex could finally take that time to recharge he'd been wanting. He'd go hide somewhere quiet, out of sight from prying eyes. He could already feel the constant cloud of oppression lifting from his mind.
Done.
He took the file and flipped it open. The first file showed a kid. His age was pegged at 25, but he didn't look a day over 20. He was hollow-cheeked, piercing blue eyes showed some spark behind them.
Alec from a Detroit factory. Why do they care so much about this kid?
Kate was looking over his shoulder, and she flipped the page.
Patricia Bond. Why does that name sound familiar?
The woman was black, strong-looking, stronger than a gruel-fed worker should be. This had Dex wondering a few things about her. His finger ran down the page. There it was. She was a suspected terrorist. At least she was now. Otherwise, her records were clean. She'd moved around to a few different work sites, farming, food preparation, and lastly, the weapons factories in a few states. She must have been good at doing her job to get shifted so much. If she was instigating trouble, they would have just killed her. It made Dex think. Trent James had said he could control where supplies went, scheduling goods, logistics, and likely even people. If the terrorists had access to his software, they'd be able to have their people moved around as needed. He swallowed hard and knew this was information he needed to keep in his back pocket.
Why are you so quiet?
Kate asked. Dex glanced away, trying not to appear guilty.
I'm reading the files. Nothing special here. I don't see this being too tough, he said.
Cleveland was walking away, and Dex held the door open, seeing the sun begin its descent into the west.
Only one problem, his boss said.
What?
Kate called after him.
Neither of their IDs are working. Seekers have been sent out, at least 10. Better hurry if either of you want a piece of the hunt.
Cleveland let out a low laugh and sauntered to the motel office, leaving Dex and Kate standing in his room's doorway.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
She asked.
Probably not,
Dex replied.
Come on, we split this job, work together. Let's call it a practice run,
she urged, and he could almost smell the desperation rise from her skin. His story about the trackers going rogue had rattled the normally hard woman, but Dex couldn't do it.
Not yet. We can stay in contact, though,
Dex said as he slipped his black leather jacket over his t-shirt. He jammed the Glock into its holster and grabbed his car keys.
May the best man win.
He knew that would ruffle her feathers. Instead of the expected barb back, she slowly nodded and looked northeast to where Detroit lay, 500 miles away. Dex waited for her to leave, taking off on the highway to the east toward the city. His car rumbled to life. He'd never grow tired of that sound. With a flip-down visor, he sped out of the parking lot, heading into the setting sun. 17. Alec. Alec thought they might hide out for a day or two in the basement of the old farmhouse, but Monet told him the enemy would be searching hot and heavy, saturating the area as soon as they found out there were 2 roamers. 3 if Crash had escaped. It was late evening by the time they reached a small town, and Alec's legs were burning fiercely. He was used to being on his feet all day, but the perpetual motion was numbing his thighs and calves. He tugged on his t-shirt and glanced down at the pair of pants Monet had called jeans. He'd seen them in one of his old magazines, but he'd never expected to wear a pair. It was the first time he hadn't worn a jumpsuit or uniform in his life.
and he wasn't sure how he felt about the attire quite yet. The pack he carried was digging into his shoulders and was heavy with food and water. None of this appeared to be bothering Monet in the least. He could tell she was slowing to let him keep up, and she was doing a good job of biting her tongue about it, too. Alec assumed the attitude wouldn't last forever. He tried to move faster, for her sake.
"How much farther?"
he asked.
"Only about 1,200 miles,
she said, without the hint of a joke behind it. 1,200 miles. It may as well have been 12,000. They walked along the tree line on a secondary road, staying away from open ground and the main interstate. Monet seemed to know what she was doing, and Alec was more than happy to let her take the lead. He had no idea where they were heading.
"Don't worry. We're going to get a lift for part of the way," she told him.
"A lift?" he asked.
"There's a supply warehouse between here and Chicago. Not a big one, but it connects to the 65 and acts as a hub."
So much of what she said was foreign to him, but he was getting used to that.
"We sneak onto a truck?"
he asked.
"There you go. Now you're picking it up."
"How far away is the warehouse?" he asked, hoping for a promising reply.
"It'll take us a couple days to get there, but I have a plan. We stashed a bike along this way for such an occasion. It's been sitting idle for a few years, but I'll make it run,"
she said with confidence.
"Good. That'll get us there faster?"
He scanned the clear blue evening sky and saw no sign of any seekers. She nodded and continued in silence. It was several more hours before she let them stop, heading down a long gravel driveway to another house. This one had fallen into decay and the house wasn't usable.
"We'll sleep in the barn," she said,
and Alex helped her open the large wooden door. Amazingly, it was less rotten than the house had been, and Alex saw bones piled in the edge of the barn from a long dead animal. He climbed the old steps into the barn's loft and pushed open what Monet had called the hayloft's door. He sat there watching as the sun lowered beyond the plush trees at the other end of the overgrown fields. He breathed deeply and leaned back as the scents of summer coursed through him. He wished that Beth were there with him to experience it. Monet stood there with her arms crossed, and she cleared her throat.
"You're reminding me of things I'd all but forgotten," she told him.
"How do you mean?" he asked.
"Sunsets, the smell of nature. I take so much for granted, and I don't notice it at all. I've been so single-minded, it's sickening."
Monet came to sit beside him, feet dangling out through the open window.
"What's the focus?"
"Them. Killing them. Taking it all back. That's the sole focus, Alec. It's the only way. I'm tired of having to hide in the shadows. It's almost time."
She was staring into the distance, the sun settled beyond the tree line.
"Time for what?"
Alec asked, thinking he knew the answer.
"Time to fight."
He didn't press her. Instead, they remained in silence for a while before unrolling sleeping bags from their packs. They stayed close to one another, and Alec realized he'd never slept in the same room as anyone else since he was a little boy. Back then, they'd shared large rooms with 10 kids occupying each space, 5 bunk beds. Now, it was strange as he listened to Monet's breathing turn deeper and into a light snore as he stared at the barn's vaulted ceiling in the near dark. Eventually, he fell asleep and dreamed of Beth dying, of the alien pressing so close to him he could smell its musk, and of his newfound freedom, which in many ways was more frightening than his captivity. He awoke to a gentle shake of his shoulders. His eyes darted open to see a smiling Monet crouching at his side.
"Rise and shine. We'll have a bite and get moving. We have a big day ahead of us," she said.
Alec rolled out of his bed, every muscle in his body protesting the movements. He'd thought he was in okay shape before, but now he knew better. Monet didn't look any worse for the wear, and he decided to keep his complaints to himself. 2 hours later, they'd made at least 6 miles, according to his companion, and his muscles were loosening up again. The sun was finally coming up when he heard the familiar whirring sound of the seeker drone. At first, he thought it was a mosquito in his ear, like the hundreds of others so far that morning. Their trudging through the deep brush was activating the swarms of the bugs, and Alec had angry red welts on his arms where he'd been bitten. Monet grabbed his arm and tugged him into the trees. She had a rifle in her hand faster than Alec could believe and was aiming it upwards as they stood motionless, backs pressed against a thick tree trunk. Bark dug in between his shoulder blades, but he didn't move. Alec had hidden from them before, but this time he was almost frozen in place with fear. He spotted the seeker as the glint of the sun's rays cascaded off its shiny body. He glanced to Monet, who was taking slow, methodical breaths beside him. She was focused, and it helped him calm down. The seeker rose higher, and the sound softened as it left their vicinity. "That was close," Alex said, and she clamped a hand over his mouth, fear in her wide eyes. Their faces were inches apart, and she let go, lifting a finger to her mouth. He got her point. The whine of the drone grew louder again, and it hovered 20 yards away. Monet crouched, and Alec joined her. After several anxiety-filled minutes, it lifted and moved away. They remained still for another 5 minutes, until Monet finally spoke.
"They're getting smarter. It was trying to trick us," she said.
Alec wasn't sure if the robots were that intelligent, but he wasn't about to argue with the woman.
"Let's keep moving."
It was hours later, 2 snacks, 1 meal, and at least 10 more mosquito bites, before Monet led them toward a shack 2 rural roads north off the main drag.
"This should be it," she said.
The long grass bent over in supplication to the increasing wind as dark clouds blew in behind them. Alec could smell the difference in the air as the sky grew black and the sun went into hiding. He saw a figure in a field, and he was startled, worried it was one of the overseers watching intently.
"Is that one of them?"
he asked, pointing at it. Monet's mood was growing foul, but she laughed at him.
"That's a scarecrow," she said, as if that was supposed to explain anything.
If she wasn't worried about it, neither was he.
"It's in here."
She led him behind another house, this one far larger than the first few they had visited.
"How do you know all of this?"
he asked her.
"They make us study. A lot. If you're an agent on the road, you have to know where to acquire food, weapons, transportation. I wish we could just hop in a car and be done with it, but it's not quite that easy. Once we enter Iowa, we should have an easier time. There isn't much of the occupation between Chicago and Las Vegas."
Monet grabbed the lock on the storage shed behind the house and thumbed a series of numbers into it. Alec heard it snap open, and she passed the lock to him as she opened the door to reveal an unfamiliar contraption.
"Not the most stylish way to transport ourselves around, but who's judging? This is an electric moped. It's basically a bicycle with a motor on it for cruising. It's going to be hell to carry both of us, but it's all we have."
She pulled out a square box and set it on the ground before unfolding some panels.
"These are solar panels to charge the motor. It'll get us where we're going, but we'll have to wait until tomorrow before we can leave."
Alec stepped into the storage shed and set his hand on the strange 2-wheeled device. He'd seen similar things lying in the streets back home.
"This is a bike?" "Sort of. I always forgot how little they teach you guys about being human."
Her eyes met his, and they revealed a profound sadness.
"I read a few books. Tom stashed some outside the facility for me and taught me how to read," Alec said. "I'm impressed. He sure took a shine to you."
Monet fiddled with the connections, and when she seemed satisfied, she grabbed his hand and pulled him away from the shed.
"It's going to rain, and I'd rather not get soaked. Let's see what's inside." Is there another of those secret rooms here?
Alec asked.
Unfortunately not. They spread things out better than that, but we might find shelter.
The roof looks sturdier than most we've passed. She was right. Monet pressed the door open and listened before stepping in.
What are you worried about finding?
Anything, people? Animals?
Monet gripped a handheld gun and aimed it forward as she passed through the front door.
Why are you scared of people?
He asked before remembering almost all of his torment had come from the hands of other humans, not the overseers.
Never mind, stupid question. Wait here,
she said and left Alec in the big house's entrance. Several minutes passed before she returned, smiling.
This is better than I thought.
Come on.
He followed her into a kitchen, and other than some dust, it was immaculate.
How has it been preserved so well?
He asked, but she shook her head without answering. She grabbed a rag from inside a cupboard, poured some water from a bottle on it, and threw it to Alec.
Wash that,
she pointed at a heavy-looking wooden table. He wiped it clean and ran a finger across its surface.
Do you ever wonder what it used to be like, Alec?
She asked. He couldn't deny it.
I do, all the time. But I have such distorted information to base it on. What was it like for you?
He asked, getting an eye roll in return.
I'm not so much older than you are. I was 7 when it all happened. A little black girl growing up in a small town north of Portland. My life consisted of school, which I loved, church, playing dolls with my big sister, and watching cartoons. I don't think anyone was ready for the drastic change. I know I wasn't.
Alec had never heard someone talk so openly about their previous life. He was teeming with questions.
Where's Portland? What happened to your family?
He asked, instantly regretting the second query.
Portland, Oregon, not Maine, which means it's on the west coast. It was beautiful. I'd like to go back sometime,
she said.
As for my family, I guess they ended up like everyone else, dead or taken to a worksite somewhere.
You've never seen them again?
Never. Probably for the best if they didn't make it. Their hearts were too full of love to live in this new world.
And you?
I used to be sweet and innocent. That disappears pretty quickly, doesn't it?
She asked, and he didn't know how to answer. She must have noticed his hesitation.
Someone lived here long ago. They had hopes and dreams, love, debt, fears, desires. Now it's empty and unused, like so much of our country. There's no getting that back, not until we rid ourselves of the overseers. They call us vermin, you know.
Alec didn't know that, but wasn't surprised by the vernacular.
Not for long, my new friend. Not for long.
Monet had a distant look in her eyes, and for the first time, Alec wondered if she was all there. He'd seen a lot of people go insane over the years, and eventually they each did something against the rules and were never heard of again. She had the glint of fanaticism in her eyes momentarily, then it was gone, replaced by a kind smile.
Enough about that. Tonight we can live like we used to. We'll make a meal, play cards at the table, like friends. How does that sound?
It sounded great to him, and he told her so.
I've never played cards. I've heard the guards talk about a game called
poker?
Then you shall learn to play poker. I hope you brought a lot of money,
she laughed.
I have some cans of food,
he grinned at her.
You're going to want to hold on to those. Never gamble with anything you're not prepared to lose. Life advice 1,
she said. I have a feeling you're going to have a lot of advice for me along this trip, he said. For the first time in forever, his shoulders relaxed. And he wasn't on the constant lookout. It felt good, like he was safe with Monet around him. They ate, played several hours of poker, Alec getting beat nearly every hand before finding areas to sleep on the living room floor. It was the best night Alec ever had. He knew they had a long road ahead, but he'd hold on to this memory for the tough times. 18. Lena. She walked nonstop. Lena didn't care about driving rain. She didn't care about her clothes and pack getting soaked through, nor that her clothes chafed and rubbed painfully. She didn't even care when she fell, grazing her hand so badly that the blood ran, rain diluted, to drip from her fingertips. She kept going, kept putting one lead-weighted foot in front of the other, and walked on until her limbs threatened abandonment. She paused, hearing some far-off noise like laughter and feeling confused. Her mind must have been playing tricks on her, misinterpreting the trickling of the heavy rainfall into the noise of a person to raise her spirits only for them to be crushed down deeper when she found out she was totally alone. Only she wasn't. She couldn't be. The sound returned, ahead and up the small bluff of a rocky lump in the gloomy distance. Something in her mind triggered again, telling her that the hill was high ground and that high ground meant a degree of safety against the things that were dangerous to her. People had always been her safety. Hunters and builders and fishermen, her protectors and providers, who in turn she fixed whenever they were injured or fell sick. She had to look after herself now, to hunt and build and fish for herself in addition to tending to her own injuries and illnesses. If the last days of walking were anything to gauge her future on, she would be alone until her luck finally ran out. Shivering, she forced her heavy feet to move again. Placing the first footfall on the start of the rocky slope, she began to climb. The wet dust turned to a cloying mud, causing her to slip and stumble. About halfway up, filthy and mostly a light gray covering her entire front from the sludge, she landed hard on her knee, prompting a cry of pain. She bit back a shout when she heard something and lifted her head to look around, certain she was being watched. Sudden and unwelcome memories of the flying silver bugs raced around her mind as they mixed and mingled with the memory of the coyotes snarling when she felt trapped in the diner. Her eyes scanned the surroundings, desperately searching for the source of her unexplained discomfort, only to see nothing beyond 20 feet in either direction. "Up here," said a hesitant voice. Unsure if she had imagined it, she raised her head to blink rainwater out of her eyes. She tried to focus on the shape of a person standing another 15 feet above her on the edge of the summit. She began crawling again with no idea if she was heading for salvation or incarceration. The figure morphed to become a half-dressed young man of about her own age, who wore a look of confusion that she guessed she probably mirrored on her own. He bent over to grasp her hand as she reached the top. The fingers twitched once as she stared at them, beckoning her to come on, to be safe and get dry. Devoid of enough energy to be suspicious any longer, she reached out, clasping the hand that radiated a heat which almost burned through her as the grip strengthened and she felt herself, in spite of the soaked clothing adding to her body weight significantly, hauled to her feet to reach the solid ground. Lena turned to face the person she hoped was her rescuer, seeing the sharp lines of a young man who, under vastly different circumstances, she would find good-looking. Her mouth opened to say something, anything, to convey her thanks, her gratitude, her relief. Nothing came out. No words could be formed in the fog of her brain, exhausted from the days spent on the run, from the mess she had made of herself trying to survive. She collapsed into him. Lena's eyes opened, but her body lay still, like some primal instinct to remain totally unmoving in the presence of a predator. She didn't know if she was in the presence of someone dangerous, only the certain knowledge that anyone surviving out in the wild was either dangerous in their own right or else with them. She blinked to try and focus on the low light in the room she found herself in. Her gaze took in the flickering orange shapes dancing on the walls as a fire burned in the corner of the room. She could smell wood smoke from the fire and something else. Food? Meat? Damp clothes?
Her ears told her very little until the sound of a throat being cleared from behind her made her flip over. She saw the young man again, panicking as his eyes shot wide, and he rapidly turned his back to her and began to mutter noises of embarrassed apology. She felt the cool air on her bare skin as she spilled out of the nest of coats and blankets she was under. She gasped as she peered down, seeing her dimpled copper skin covered only by her underwear.
"My clothes!"
she gasped, shooting a look at the young man full of accusation and shock, which was entirely wasted against his back.
"Where the hell are my clothes?"
"There," he stammered, stopping as though he wasn't sure of his words. "They're hanging by the fire," he said finally, sounding as awkward as she felt.
"Get out!"
she snapped, repeating the order in a voice made shriller by fear and confusion when he didn't respond fast enough.
"Out!"
He fled, a scrape of boot on stone signaling his departure as she clutched a rough spun blanket around her and ignored the itching it tortured her with. Lena ignored the dampness of the stiff clothes, which had dried hard in places where the flames had done their job. She pulled her new pants on, but abandoned the top as it was still wet on the back and made her shiver. She retrieved a thick padded coat from the pile she had slept under and wrapped it almost twice around her thin frame, as it was far too big for her. Holding it tight to her body, she stuffed her bare feet into her damp boots without bothering to lace them up. Looking around, she saw her pack and shotgun resting against a wall, electing to pick up the gun as it would make her feel more able to hold a safe conversation with whoever this man was. She stepped outside, her nose filling with the fresh warm scent of a thirsty landscape so soon after a downpour gratefully received. She saw him standing on the far side of a small courtyard and looking in her direction, but with his eyes cast slightly downwards, as though he couldn't look directly at her. She stalked straight towards him, faltering only when a growl came from an open doorway to her left. She staggered, struggling to raise the shotgun, and pointed in the direction of the noise to hold it awkwardly.
"No!"
he cried, running towards her with his hands raised. He stopped close to her, keeping his distance, but also maintaining an occasional wary glance over his shoulder at the doorway and the source of the growling.
"Please, don't,"
he said simply. Lena was confused, starving, utterly bewildered by what had happened in the last few hours alone.
"Please don't,"
he said again, softer this time.
"Who are you?"
she demanded, the faint sound of a sob edging her words.
"What is this place? What's in there?"
She raised the barrel of the shotgun to point it at the storeroom.
"I'm Cole," he told her, his voice pleading. "This is my temporary home, and that's a coyote."
She had so many questions. She looked at him and saw that he was not quite the person she had first thought. He was younger, not much older than her.
"You need food,"
he said, gesturing for her to go inside. She obliged and entered the doorway. Lena's eyes took in the boy, sitting opposite her and focused on another weapon within an arm's reach of him. He held both hands up in a placatory gesture, reaching slowly for a bottle of clean plastic with clear water inside. He held it out for her, his hand shaking slightly as she reached out cautiously to take it from his gentle grasp. He withdrew, reaching to his side, away from the gun and coming towards her with a wire tray containing strips of what appeared to be dried meat. She hesitated, then almost snatched the tray from him and began tearing at the meat hungrily.
"Go slow,"
he said. His words sounded awkward somehow, stilted, as though he was out of practice at talking, to another person at least. He held out a small rough container with a lumpy purple paste inside. She stopped chewing to stare at the bowl, then at him.
"Juniper berries,"
he told her.
"It'll make the turkey sweeter."
She said nothing, instead scooping out a portion of the berry mush with a chunk of meat and stuffing it into her mouth, along with the mouthful she hadn't yet swallowed.
"What's your name?"
Cole asked softly.
Lena,
she said, looking at his arms.
Are you one of them?
In answer, Cole held up both hands and turned them around to show no indication of markings. She stopped chewing. She'd heard talk in her village of other people who hadn't fallen under the control of the aliens who'd overturned their planet so long ago, before either of them had been born.
I'm no one, just a guy. Out here by myself, Cole told her.
It's good to meet you, Cole,
she said, before automatically adding an instinctive,
Yate.
His forehead wrinkled, changing the shape of his face completely until she explained.
It means hello. It's the way my people greet each other in our own language,
she told him, her face falling as she realized that of her people, she might be the last.
Oh,
Cole answered, eyes still not meeting hers.
Hello.
Where are you from?
She asked as they sat around.